Shrink Wrap Radio number 910, Michael Alsay, PhD, on the upside of OCD.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, when just enough to make it dangerous, it's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest is Michael Alsay, PhD, discussing his latest book, The Upside of OCD. He asserts that OCD is a misunderstood existential and empathic sensitivity that has served the life and work of many notable OCD sufferers. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Michael Alsay, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, David.
Well, it's been about 2 years since you've been on the show discussing your book on therapeutic improvisation. And today we're going to discuss your subsequent book on the upside of OCD. How did you come to write this book?
OCD has always been a little hobby horse of mine since my grad school days. But I've always felt that there was more to OCD than clinicians and even sufferers talked about. And while I was doing it in practice, I was like, why should I hoard all this information to myself? I should write about it.
Yeah, yeah. So what made you feel suspicious about, that some of it was being hoarded and not put out to the world?
Well, you know, right now, as you probably know, and many therapists know, like the mainstay dominant model is a cognitive behavioral model for treating OCD, exposure response prevention, medication, maybe a little acceptance commitment therapy. But there's not much that looks at feelings and relationship and meaning within OCD. I think because there's a little bit of the field has a trauma response because, you know, psychoanalysis made it feel like it was very ineffective for OCD. So therefore, anything that gets close to that seems sort of dubious. And I really felt like, wait a minute, what if we could blend these things together?
Yeah, and your book is written directly to OCD sufferers. And I wonder if you yourself were ever diagnosed with OCD.
Yeah. I really wanted it to be written directly to sufferers because I wanted it to echo the kind of lived experience that they have, which was mine as well. I write about in the book, my mom had severe OCD, contamination kind of OCD, and the kind of reassurance seeking and doubting and things like that. And I too, when I was young, one of my earliest OCD symptoms was these intrusive thoughts that if I didn't do my prayers correctly or if I was immoral in some way, that my mom would die.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, out of the blue, just, you know, all of a sudden, and I remember coming home from school and hugging her for dear life, thinking, gosh, I might have lost her today. And you know, the OCD would morph into other forms throughout my life, right? Making sure that I took notes impeccably in high school and college, you know, as if I was the teacher was spreading gospel, right? You know, reassurance seeking in every which way, doubting my own kind of ideas and things like that. And, you know, what I really wanted to get at the book is that despite all these seeming downsides of OCD, there's a lot of hidden upsides that we don't really talk about. And that when we connect, that actually help with the downsides.
Well, as you learned about OCD and the general attitudes towards it, I wonder, did you feel Did you feel a need to defend it, to defend yourself?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, totally. I mean, I think some of the great, you know, psychological writers kind of find something in themselves, hopefully, to share with the world and hopefully speak to something larger. Yeah, I felt that there was missing poetry in the literature and research and treatment on OCD. I felt like having OCD was a lot more nuanced, and also being a person with, I call it a sensibility of sensitivity. I think people with OCD have a profound empathic sensitivity that when not understood and validated and supported can go haywire. And I also think that people with OCD have an extremely imaginative mind, and without, again, proper understanding of how that they're like border collies. You know, if you don't give a border collie good enough exercise, it's going to tear apart the place.
And right.
People with OCD, I'm actually stealing that from Elizabeth Gilbert, the writer. And people with OCD have very active minds and very generous hearts. And when they're not given proper exercise and support, they start to take it out on themselves. And so I really did have a personal stake in changing the dialogue on what OCD is, what people are who struggle with it. And that's one of the reasons why I highlighted so many people who are famous with OCD, like Charles Darwin or Nikola Tesla or author John Green or Greta Thunberg, Jack Antonoff, the musician. I really wanted to showcase that there's a lot more richness and texture to what is the OCD experience.
Well, I'm glad you did, and I'm glad that you that you're sharing this with us now. And I hope we have lots of OCD listeners, who the people who are privileged to have that sensitivity that you're talking about and experience, and like other things, I imagine it's probably on some kind of a distribution of from lots to little. And probably all of us can relate to it in one way or another.
And, you know, you said something funny, too, that I wanted to point out. I think there's a high proportion of therapists who have either OCD or OCD tendencies. And when you look at one of the earliest cases, Freud did a wonderful case. Paul L. was the rat man case, and he was the classic OCD case. And when Paul was a young man, he was intrigued by Freud's writing because he said, "You actually write the way my mind thinks." In other words, the way that we question and are curious as psychologists in its best days is creatively obsessional. And so I think there's a high correlation between those of us in this field who have, if not a touch, a good portion of it. And my hope is to figure out how we could use that not just for our patients, but for ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my feeling is if you don't have OCD, when you start graduate school, particularly in psychology, you're gonna have to learn to develop it
a little bit.
yeah, because you sort of, for one thing, in psychology, you're taught to question everything and to kind of doubt everything, and hold it up to an analytic light, and that's kind of how you described your own experience as a kid. That you found yourself questioning aspects of reality and so on, and that makes sense. And we talk about obsessive compulsive and graduate school, particularly psychology, I think, really trains you to to be obsessive and compulsive. You have to be if you're going to get through it.
You do, just like being a doctor, right? Like a medical doctor, you have to be really. You know, I think that's a really important point. This is part of the human condition. And when I think of people with OCD, is that they have also a big range. And that's one of the things that I set out to write this book to talk about, the range of thought and range of feeling, the scope, the fuller scope of it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, actually, you didn't start out in psychology or psychotherapy. You started out in music. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I'm sure you've probably given some thought to that, but I'd like you to think about it right now, is in what ways music has informed your sensibilities about OCD, your understanding of it. For example, I seem to recall research that suggests that musicians turn out to be particularly good as programmers, because of the patterns and so on. And,
Yeah.
So how has music gifted you in this pursuit?
That's a really beautiful connection, because I hadn't thought about it in this way, David. But in a way, if you think about it, music does two things that are so apropos to OCD. One, music is about learning how to read the changes we talked about, right? In therapy, we're learning how to read the changes of emotions and thoughts that are constantly moving. But we're trying to detect patterns to see where there are places that we can get some constants within the change. And music is about having change and variation within form. And so music really showcases the best of being emotionally connected to something, but analytically very, very precise. And that's the other thing about music, is that it's the best of both worlds. You have to be very, very analytically sharp to be a good musician, but you also have to be very emotionally available and expressive, very generous. And so I think, you know, music is a great example of how our minds work. And when I think of OCD, I don't just think of the mind, I think of the heart. I think they have as roving and open a heart as they do a mind. And when you see that, that's what music is. Music touches your heart, but it also sometimes speaks to, you know, that something bigger, right?
Yeah.
That's also
mine.
And I do think there's some real connection. And that's why I think, you know, watching people who kind of, like Charles Darwin is a great example. Here's a guy who struggled throughout his life with asking for reassurance, worrying about the potential death of his children. His mother died when he was fairly young, so he also was semi-traumatized by that. But he also had this roving mind that was always looking at new angles on things, right? And
what was the name? Who was it?
It was Charles Darwin.
Charles Darwin.
Yeah, and most people think of him because of Spencer's, you know, idea of him being survival of the fittest. But I think it was, I forget who said it. I'm looking at my books here. The gentleman who writes about awe, what's his name? Dacher. You know who I'm talking about.
I do.
So he had this beautiful quote that Darwin really was about survival of the kindest, because he felt that the most evolved in us were morally generous and caring for each other. And it's one of the things that I think people forget about when they think about OCD. They often think about this worrying mind, but they forget about this really, really open heart. And I think one of the things about music that connects it back is that I think music always connects the heart.
Yeah. And now, music, of course, is very broad. And, you know, there's music theory, there's music performance, et cetera. So what are you, a performing musician? What's your instrument, or are you more into the music theory, or is it all?
So I'm really an amateur. I work at Manhattan School of Music with all these professional jazz musicians, classical musicians, and and growing up, I studied classical and jazz. But for me, it really was, I think music was another way to put the kind of depth of what you're thinking and feeling into form. And I think, you know, we've talked about this when I talked about the first book, Therapeutic Improvisation. I think therapy is such an artful process, and that when we're deeply connecting with people, we are allowing new forms to come and also allowing new forms to be seen. And I think music does that in this exquisite way. And yes, I'm a pianist by training. So when you think of the piano, what I love about the piano is like the piano has like the greatest range of all the instruments. And so, you know, the piano is where all the greats used to practice playing the orchestra parts for their concerti, you know. So the thing that I love about the piano, I think it kind of really evokes the emotional range of being human.
Wow. Yeah, I'm so jealous of you in that regard, because I actually tried to, you know, My grandmother wanted me to learn to play piano when I was a kid, and I didn't want to practice. And plus, she didn't play piano. She didn't know how to play piano, but she was trying to, you know, teach me some of the basics from books and would try to get me to practice. And the thing that really hooked me later was I was really drawn to folk music during the whole folk boom. And took up the guitar, and then later I really wanted to learn to play the piano, and I tried it from different perspectives, and particularly some of the teachers that I worked with wanted to teach me improvisational piano. And I discovered to my, and I realize now in retrospect what my big problem was, partly due to aging, but I think just partly due to whatever kind of brain I have, memory is not, isn't my strong suit. It's funny, I remember stuff. I think, for example, I think you were probably referring to Dacher Keltner.
That's right.
Was the name that you were reaching for?
Yes, that's what I was reaching for. Yep.
You know, and it's funny how I'll have that. I can pull that out of my head. But on playing the piano, I learned the chords and the notes and all. But at one point, my teacher who had emphasized, look at your hands like baby hands without judgment. You know, so that's where he was coming from. And so I did that, but then I felt really rebuffed at a later point when he said, this is not music. You're just wandering around on the keyboard. And it's because I couldn't remember the pattern that I couldn't establish a pattern that I could repeat because I was just wandering and I didn't know where I'd been.
Yeah,
and that was very frustrating, and still is. I finally had to give up.
But you know, I want to give you some consolation on this, David, and also to other therapists out there. You know, I'm really a hack at improvising. I'm really bad at it. I wish that I was as good at improvising as I always dreamed to be. But what I found is, as a therapist, I'm a really good improviser. Mm-hmm. And I can, just like you, I can remember people's stories and I can remember the metaphors or the different pieces.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Jung said something, right? The mind plays with that which it loves, right? And that's where the creative act comes. And I think it's really important to see that musicality is something that we do every day in our sessions. And that's sort of the reason that I wanted to write about this, to look at more of the musicality of what is it like to improvise with a very overactive mind and very overactive heart.
Yeah.
Right. And just like you, I took piano lessons, and at first I took them and I hated them and I gave them up. And it was only when my mom, I said, I want to play like Billy Joel. And my mom said, I'm going to get you a teacher who will teach you Billy Joel. And I'm like, I'm in.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So there had to be an in. And I think really it's so important that there's something about connecting to that place, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, was to connect to that, like that heart and soul of this particular thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really drawn to the blues and to country blues and boogie woogie and, you know, the sort of the African American experience, partly because I grew up in a racially mixed family, and so I was exposed a lot to the black side of life as a result of that. And that's somewhere, you know, they talk about soul food, etc. And I have to acknowledge that even though I feel like I've been overeducated in a way that creates a lot of distance between me and the world of blackness, that it does speak to my soul.
Yeah, I can't find the quote here, but Quincy Jones has a great book called 12 Notes, and he writes about his it's a memoir slash sort of inspirational guide. And he says, there's the science of music, and there's the science of life, and then there's the poetry and the soul of it. And the soul of it is sort of what you're talking about. And that's, again, that was the reason why I wanted to write this book, to talk a little bit more about the soul of this particular condition that is very, very human and very, very intriguing and very rich. So, you know, it's exciting to be able to share it with therapists, because the other thing is I looked at all the books out there, you know, and I was like, wait, there's not as much new angles on this particular. I wanted to mix up the blues.
Yeah.
I wanted to play some new changes here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I wanted to say, like, hey, this is a great standard. I love this tune. Let's see what else we can do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So in your book, you know, as I mentioned, you write directly to people who are, and it's not right to call them sufferers.
Yeah.
if they're sufferers, it's only because our judgments as a society and as a professional have put it in given it a negative cast.
Yeah, maybe people who live with OCD, right? Who live with it.
Yeah. Many people who, what's the rest of that sentence?
People who live with OCD, right? They're not just sufferers. They live with it. And there's life within it as well.
Yeah. 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 And so maybe you can take us through, and you're doing therapy with people. So what are the steps that you take people through?
Yeah, you know, a big part is recognizing how sensitive they are emotionally, and how quick they are to be sensitive to others, but how much less sensitive they are to themselves. People with OCD are extremely thoughtful and worried about others, but they're extremely critical and hostile to themselves. And they also they get really cagey around disagreeing, being angry, setting a boundary. It's almost like those sides are not allowed. Like if you, and it makes sense, if you feel so much, like if you feel the feelings of others, it's almost like you're hearing everybody else's music and you lose track of your own music. And in a lot of ways, I think people with OCD also then start to feel like, well, what's my music? Everybody else has all this stuff going on.
Yeah, yeah. And well, so they must, I think, they must feel really, really heard to when you say these things to them. I would think they would feel very seen and heard and valued at a deep level, which is healing. I mean,
that's the thing that I think are one of the most important things. I want people with OCD to feel more seen and more seen in this particular area, which is how deeply feeling they are, but how difficult it is for them to stay in touch with their own feelings. And I think that's another reason why they go into their worried minds to control all this stuff, right? Yeah. And so one piece is just recognizing that. I call it, like I said, it's a sensibility of sensitivity. That's the nature part of it. I feel like people with OCD have a nature, a temperament that is really tuned, highly tuned.
Yeah.
But then, of course, if you're highly tuned, then you start to think about all this stuff that you're feeling. And then you start to worry and wonder, what if that happens? Or what if I did that? Or what if I thought that? And all the what ifs. And that could be really interesting if it's balanced, right? And so the second part of what I like to do is to look at the imaginative mind of the OCD person and say, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, you're right. There are a lot of what ifs. How do we make them into why nots? Meaning, why not? Let's see what's possible here. And also, let's see, I talk later in the book about how to balance out this self-criticism with a little bit more of the muse. I've been really intrigued by Maggie Jackson wrote this beautiful book about the power of uncertainty. It's called The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. She wrote a lovely endorsement for the book. I was really grateful for it. And in this book, she talks about how much more powerful trusting uncertainty is. There's a lot of creative possibility there. And I think people with OCD can bring that power. They can transform this malignant doubt into creative possibility.
Yeah.
And so,
you know, as a podcaster, I've struggled with the fact that, I think more generally, I've struggled with accepting myself as somebody who's not really specialized and gone super deep in a certain area, like you're supposed to do.
Yes.
You know, you're supposed to become an expert and be really committed to something. And then the picture of science as it's portrayed generally is that, you become really committed to a theory or a perspective. And of course, and then science, and we're taught that scientists are open to changing their ideas and their theories. But in fact, it doesn't appear to be that way at all. Somehow they are so convinced that they know how it is that they just will keep trying experiment after experiment after experiment until finally they can reveal, see, this is how it is. I sort of sensed it, which I think is interesting.
That yeah,
there's
you actually
this, think of, this, there's yeah. this intuitive aspect, I think, to
yeah.
science.
Yeah. That's right, and that's exactly what I'm getting at. So people with OCD have an intuitive sixth sense.
Yeah.
They have a sixth sense, and I think the reason I wanted to write this book was to talk more about that, because I don't think there's enough press on it, both for people who live with OCD, but also for therapists to tap into that, the power of that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of wealth there, and there's something that you just said about that scientific, you know, stance. There's something really beautiful about being able to be creative, to open to these different possibilities.
Yeah.
And that is something that I think is difficult in this culture, right?
Yeah.
And it's more difficult with polarization. And actually, that's what I thought is so powerful about people with OCD. One of the things that both Sigmund Freud and Anna Freud said about people with OCD is that they are racked by tremendous ambivalences, both tremendous love and connection, and at times hate that they feel like they can't control. And to me, it gets at the full Shakespearean range of what it's like to feel so broadly, which is what it is to be fully human. And the thing that I think is the saving grace for people with OCD, just as it is for our culture, is to lean into nuance. That I can be this and that and something in between. And to paraphrase Walt Whitman, whatever contradictions, that's okay. I am large. I contain multitudes, right? As he would say.
Yeah.
And nuance is an interesting word, as I write about in the book. It comes from the French word for nuage, which means cloud. You know, because when you look at clouds, you see all this dimension and shape. But yet when we think of something that's cloudy, we think of something that's obscured. What a beautiful paradox to have something that's obscured that also has more dimension. And I think people with OCD struggle with noticing that constant conflict between these things.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Joni Mitchell's song. And
Both Sides Now.
Both Sides Now, yeah.
One of my favorite
songs, and so profound, and my condemnation of my condemning voice has said, I'm a dilettante because and some years ago I met with a graduate committee in which I was supposed to. I already had a PhD and so on. It was a faculty committee in which we were supposed to look at ourselves and get feedback from our peers. And, you know, somehow that it came out that I had this condemning sense of, you know, having failed for being, quotes, a dilettante. But then, you know, but they were able to get me to see that I'm not a dilettante, I'm a generalist.
Or a Renaissance man.
Okay, I like that even better.
Da Vinci wasn't just a dilettante, right? But one could make the argument, oh, I think you're right too. I think that's the beauty of this. I think it's also hard because sometimes we live in a culture that says, wait, wait, you should have things really sharply specialized. Even here's my funny take on OCD. I think it's wonderful what CBT and ERP and ACT Act have brought to the OCD world. And yet at the same time, sometimes I think they get a little obsessional, right? That it's okay to do the Joni Mitchell thing and see both sides. In fact, when I wrote the book, I was really inspired by these two business writers, Marianne Lewis and Wendy Smith, who wrote a wonderful book called Both and Thinking. And it's about how finding these really interesting solutions in business and politics by kind of blending things that seem to really not fit and working the paradox.
Yes.
And I really think, you know, as you know, in my first book, I felt that way too, as being a really good therapist is being a good, is a paradox. You're an uber listener as a therapist, and you should also be an uber talker.
You should be
giving much back as you're taking in. It really should be back. And so I think you're right, David. I mean, I think it's a wonderful sign of having that range again, that scope.
You've got some interesting chapter titles in your book. One is Masterminding OCD. What does that mean, masterminding it?
Yeah, I was trying to find a good metaphor. So the first part of that is all this good inside, because most people with OCD think that all this stuff is just terrible, right? OCD throws like the worst stuff at you. All of the, you know, DEFCON 5 fears that get thrown at you. But masterminding it in a way, from my sense, is realizing, wait, you're just in touch with the full range of things. And as long as you, again, like you said, David, don't think, oh my gosh, I have to have it all figured out immediately.
Yeah.
Let me see what I can notice and work with this stuff. And that's both emotional as well as thought-wise. Because one of the things I write about in the book is how OCD is tricky. It both throws you off the trail and distracts you from what's important, and it's trying to focus you. In other words, if a client, like I said in the book, had an obsession that she was going to get brain damage if anybody touched her, she was very worried about this.
Yeah.
And when I looked at the context of when this obsession came out, she was at work and somebody, a friend, playfully hit her. Playfully. But she was not assertive enough to say that she didn't like it or she, you know, was bothered by it. Yeah. And all of a sudden, this obsession cropped up. Now, the obsession, she's not really going to get brain damage, but was she feeling uncomfortable around taking the aggression of taking up space and saying no completely? And so masterminding OCD is learning how to see the richness of how it's trying to give you a message, but it's an exaggerated form. It's a messenger of sorts if you learn how to decode it.
I'm remembering a patient that I worked with when I was pretty young as a therapist who had an obsession that that maybe he had run over people on his bicycle. Mm-hmm. And somehow it didn't seem to yield to reason. You know, you could say, well, if you ran over somebody on your bicycle, you would really feel it, like it would throw you probably off your bicycle. But that didn't seem to be a terribly helpful intervention, as I recall.
You know, and some of the part too is that the feeling is so big, right? The feeling of the potential for doing something so awful. Sometimes I think one of the exposure exercises should be being with the feeling, not like the not necessarily the situation, right? It feels like the most horrible thing in the world, right? And then I'd wonder, like, what were you feeling before? Like, were you feeling like you were rushing home? Like, what was going on, you know? Yeah. In other words, there's a fuller context. I know that people with OCD therapists don't like to focus on the content of obsession so much because they feel like that's providing reassurance and going down the rabbit hole. But I think looking at the context is helpful, right? Like, why now?
Yeah. Right?
And you're right, though. And I think that's part of the reason, too, is that, guys, I think sometimes you can't always work these things through the mind. Now, I think it's interesting about CBT is they try to work through going through the behavior, which is very useful. I think what I wish they would do a little bit more as well is to say, wait, let's go into the feeling place a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah.
What does it feel like all of a sudden to feel like you could be a terrible person?
Did you have people who tried to work with you using CBT techniques? And what was that like for you?
Yeah, you know, they have. I've had people who wanted to do some of that stuff. I've also had people who did the CBT and felt like there was more that they felt they were missing, or that the CBT worked to a certain extent. One person that I can distinctly remember recently said, you know, Mike, I did the exposure exercises and they helped, but every time I wanted to talk about more about, let's say, my relationship and what it feels like, they would say, well, I don't want to give you reassurance because, you know, you doubt about relationships. And it felt like there was, it inhibited the person from being able to really get into more of the full story. And as we unpacked the story, there was a lot of, not so many reasons about the relationship, but about the person's backstory that were coming yeah. up through some of these questions and doubts that, yes, they were, like, I had a mentor who once said that obsessions are like magnets. They take a lot of material and they kind of focus them in one area.
Mm-hmm.
And what's strange about it is that it makes it feel like that's it.
Yeah.
But ironically, it's not just it. And so I think one of the things with OCD treatment is I would like us more as therapists to zoom in and to pan out. Mm-hmm. And to pan out to see, wait, what's the fuller context of what's happening emotionally? What just happened relationally, right?
Yeah.
Or what happened in the person's story? So this person who had a relationship concern, she grew up in a family which was very emotionally unreliable and less, not very sensitive.
Yeah.
And so she was very concerned about getting involved with anybody who could be emotionally unreliable. This wasn't just a random obsession. This had some meaningful connection.
Yeah. You've got a chapter called Making Meaning in the Face of Death. And tell us about
big one,
that.
Right? Yeah, you know, it's so funny. It's a big one. And the reason I thought it deserved a special chapter is because when you look at every form of OCD, whether it's harm OCD or contamination OCD or relationship OCD, what unifies them, and Freud said this too, is the ultimate fear of death. The fear of something could happen to someone that I love and need and care about. Something could happen to myself, including I could lose relationships, which is a psychological death. So I joke there's an old game called 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. You know, like you could yeah. find the movie which relates. And I think the Kevin Bacon is death. In OCD, everything comes back to death, which is the Kevin Bacon. And again, I don't think we talk about that enough because, you know, I think we right now treatment leans toward not looking at too much meaning because you're afraid. Like Jonathan Grayson, an OCD expert, says something really brilliant. He says, people with OCD are extremely philosophical. They think about all the important questions. The only difference is, unlike people without OCD, they want the answer. Right? Mm. And he's right. They do want the answer. But I also think it's important for us to look at, wait, maybe that's okay to look at through an existential lens, that this is a very intensified, being tuned in a very intensified way, an existential sensitivity. Yeah. I said before that I think people with OCD have a sixth sense for empathy. I also think they have a heightened existential sensitivity. And I think if we looked at it through that lens, we could help understand that there's a lot of good stuff out of that, right? Darwin, you know, the funny thing is, for someone who was so worried about death, he figured out how life goes on, right? Huh. Greta Thunberg, who was, you know, horrified when she was a child seeing environmental devastation, has taken that as a call to action to try and, you know, advocate, you know, for climate change, or right. you know, working on climate change.
Yeah.
And so I think what I wanted to get at with the, you know, making meaning is that there's such a taboo about meaning in OCD. And I don't, I think, like I said, OCD has its meaningless, distracting elements, and it has its meaningful ones. And I think when we bring those things together, we have a much more powerful treatment for OCD. And I think actually you get more buy-in from people with OCD. Because yeah. as much as, you know, ERP is successful, there's a good proportion of people that don't even want to touch it with a 10.5-foot pole. Right?
Yeah, right. You know, as theoretically, the thing that's drawn me in psychology has been the existential approach, which is all about death and doubt and, you know, and...
But doesn't Yalom say if we can face death and look it in the eye, we can actually live life?
Yeah.
And so the upside for me of OCD is seeing it's not just that they're tormented by death, they're so aware of the beauty and preciousness of life.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is the upside.
Yeah. So your book, is your book out yet?
It's coming out in November. It's out for pre-order on, you know, Amazon and Roman and Littlefield, where it's published and all that stuff.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So that's very exciting. And have you got, you must have given presentations at conferences and so on, maybe, where you're putting these ideas out there, and I wonder what, you know, how they've been received.
I gave my first this week, actually. I went to the International the International OCD Foundation, which is a wonderful organization, and I led this support group about the upside, and I was so struck at how people were sort of delighted to be able to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You know, it's like this open secret, I think, within the community, that there's these interesting upsides. And without saying, I was very clear, we're not glamorizing or glorifying this at all. We're saying this has lots of downsides, but this is also a part of one's identity. It's sort of like a part of your sensibility. If you're an introvert, that's part of your sensibility, right?
Yeah.
I do think that this is a really important thing that people with OCD have not put words to. And it was really exciting to see people be like, oh, I never thought of it like that. Yeah, I am really empathic to a fault. I am really hard on myself. Uh-huh. Huh, I am really uncomfortable with being a little bit more of a contrarian.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm really excited to see when clinicians read it too, if they get excited about, wait, there's more we can do with this. There's even more that we can add to our package of treatment.
Yeah. That's funny that you say contrarian, because one of the questions that I had formulated to ask you about, but then I thought, no, I'm not going to go there, involves, you know, well, are you generally a contrarian?
It's funny. I'm not. That's what I think the reason why it took me so long to even put this out there. So I did my dissertation on OCD with Dean McKay, who's a big researcher in the OCD world. And he was very, very, you know, very much up to date on all the empirically backed stuff. And when I learned everything from him, but I was taking all these other classes on existentialism and psychoanalysis at the same time, and I was doing a training in ERP, and I said to him, hey, would you be willing to sponsor me on a dissertation where I bring together cognitive behavioral therapy and psychodynamic and attachment theory to look at OCD? And he's like, sure. And, you know, I did that thinking, okay, that was fun and that was interesting, and I thought, I'm not a contrarian. I'm not going to try and change the dialogue on this. And, you know, I wrote my first book and I thought, well, maybe I should put this out there.
Yeah, right. Well, Michael, it's been such a delight to speak with you. And I think these ideas are going to really catch fire among the people who can benefit from them most, and will, in fact, be a breath of fresh air, or maybe a torrent of fresh air in the field.
I love it.
Which we're ready for. So, and so I want to thank you too for gracing me to come back and be one of the people that would interview you as it was still tender and just coming out.
Thank you so much, David. I always have such a good time talking and riffing together. See, you're a musician at heart.
Yes, thank you, thank you. Okay, well, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio, and I look forward to maybe other adventures that we'll have together. It was thrilling to have the opportunity to work with Michael Alce again. I had forgotten just how lively a personality he has. On the one hand, he is an advocate for a contrarian view of OCD, while he speaks out with great excitement for the positive aspects and potentials of the OCD mind. He is not in denial about the limitations and the pain that often accompanies OCD. Whatever its blessings, he knows from personal experience that there's no getting around the stigma that others place on people suffering from OCD, as well as the way those external judgments tend to become internalized into a kind of self-hatred. In addition, there are the real-life inefficiencies of having to take time to engage in one's compulsions and/or obsessions. Also, I have the impression that OCD, like other disabilities, probably exists along a spectrum from highly disruptive to mildly disruptive. I had the opportunity to experience what a healing presence Michael presents. As I confessed to some of my own limitations, he was so very reassuring. For example, I have at times labeled myself as a dilettante, rather than celebrating the breadth I express and enjoy as a generalist. I have a wide-ranging curiosity and openness to others that I bring to this work. As you will have heard in our interview, Michael's PhD is in music rather than psychotherapy. Although he's done much to develop expertise as a therapist, I was moved to share with him my own frustrations as a wannabe musician, having taken many stabs in that direction as an adult. As I tried to learn improvisational piano, I found I was limited by memory handicaps that prevented me from remembering the phrases I had just played, such that the end result was a aimless wandering on the keyboard. Michael was so affirming and actually healing in his reactions to my struggles as a musician. I really appreciate that about him, and it's easy for me to see what a healing presence he brings to the clients that he works with. For me, our conversation flowed as a kind of jazz. As time has gone by, I've come to recognize many OCD-type characteristics in my own personality, to what extent those were created by graduate study, and to what extent they were already present, I'm not sure. Michael has addressed his book on the upside of OCD to the OCD-afflicted readers in his audience, and I can enthusiastically endorse this book and his work to anyone who is dealing with these issues themselves. I also think that he has an important message for the psychotherapeutic community to widen their views about those who are similarly afflicted.
Caroline, a passionate and avid listener from Zurich, Switzerland. I love Shrink Wrap Radio because the shows are very inspiring, motivational, and educational. They cover a wide range of diverse topics presented in an entertaining and articulate way. In particular, what draws me to the show is Dr. Dave himself as a person. He's an incredibly erudite professor in both worlds of psychology, in the academic/mainstream and, quote, more alternative fields. And he's an excellent and empathetic listener. This makes him as a unique host, and maybe this is the hidden secret of getting Shrink Wrap Radio addicted. There is no other podcast show that I could think of that offers this combination. Thank you so much, and I hope you will continue the show for a while, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Caroline, there in Zurich, Switzerland. I really appreciate your appreciation for the way that I conduct the show and for the personal characteristics I bring to it. Also, thank you for encouraging others to follow your fine example. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Big thanks to Michael Alsay for his revisioning of OCD and for sharing so openly with us. At this point, I'm not sure who our next guest will be, but I can guarantee you that it will be someone really good. So I hope you'll join us then. And until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves, others, and our precious Earth.
All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.